Avdiivka right now in the hand of Russians. When you look at this conflict right now in Ukraine, in your opinion, where is it going? I know that you wrote an article together with our friend of this show, Larry Wilkerson, about sending more good money after bad. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, for the Ukrainians and for those who support the Ukrainians, those who use Ukraine as a proxy in this war against Russia, it's going very badly. I can't imagine it going any worse. There are no more Ukrainian soldiers to speak of. There is no more artillery shell provision. The weapons they have been not successful for the most part. And worse still, one of their strongholds, Avdiivka, which was actually the site from which they were shelling Donetsk city, has finally fallen. And the point is that it's fallen much more quickly than anyone ever expected. Usually the Russians are very measured in how they do attrition. You know, they attrit. Well, they started to do that, but just yesterday and the day before, the Ukrainians pretty much collapsed, okay? And now they're ordered to leave Avdiivka. So even the Ukrainians admit they've lost there. What do they have left? Not much. And even their famous brigades, like the Azov Brigade, has been decimated. As soon as, you know, the surveillance from the sky is so precise by the Russians, by the Americans, by anybody who has satellites, okay, that you can't gather troops or tanks or anything else into one mass because they'll be found and they'll be shot and they'll be blasted to hell. So the Ukrainians made the mistake under this new commander, Sirsky. Oh, we're going to bring our crackerjack troops here from the Azov battalion down to help out in Avdiivka. We'll put them to the west of Avdiivka, and they got obliterated. Now, this is not funny. It's so sad. These people are being sacrificed. For what? For the whims of journals generals in Ukraine or Nuland, who appeared there last week and said, no, you guys persist. We need you to persist, you know? So it's so sad. And with the Ukrainians admitting now that Avdiivka has been lost, there's not much left to prevent the Russians from moving forward. Now, we have always kind of wondered, you know, why aren't the Russians moving to the Dnieper River, for God's sake? Well, you know, military analysts, I was one for 2 years on active duty. We look at maps, right? You know, if you look at the distance between where Russia holds the territory now, those four oblasts, those four provinces, well, there's an awful lot of Ukraine left between them and the Dnieper River. So, yeah, it makes sense for the Russians to just get kind of gradually, you know? And if there's nothing in the way, well, who needs to go all the way to the Dnieper and try to occupy all that part of Ukraine and subject themselves to the kind of insurgency that they were subjected to Soviet troops in Afghanistan or American troops in Afghanistan or American troops in Vietnam, okay? I mean, hello. They're smarter than that. So I think they're ready for a deal. I think Zelensky is a really smart guy to get out of town. He's being wined and dined in Western Europe. Well, the place is going to hell. There's a chance he might not come back. You know, he might go to one of his villas. Meanwhile, the military leadership is really strange because Zelensky is still around, apparently, although he's not but Sirsky, and, you know. So the intrigue in Kiev is another factor to take into consideration here. The bottom line is that the only hope that any of them had was to have more money and more arms. Now, take more money. More money is not going to produce more arms in time to reverse what's happened here at JFK and elsewhere. So what's more money for? More money is for demonstrating on the part of the United States that we will support Ukraine no matter what. We'll support them no matter how, well, we used to say how long it takes. Now we say for as long as we can. And that's the rub, Nima. We can't anymore. Because some sensible souls in Congress have said, this doesn't make any sense. And we're not going to give 60 billion more on top of the, what, 100, on top of the 80 billion already given them. We're not going to do it anymore, okay? Because we have other concerns in our country. Now, that's the House of Representatives. Now, the leader of the House, a fellow named Mike Johnson, who came up from nowhere, has been pretty strong on this, but he's under incredible pressure. I mean, real pressure from the White House, from the Pentagon, from the neocons like Max Boot, writing about, oh, so you're going to give in to the Russians, and the Russians will keep going not only to the Dnieper River, not only to the border of Romania, so forth. They'll go all the way. They'll go to Poland, and they'll go to the Baltic. Before you know it, they'll be on the English Channel. I mean, it makes no sense at all. But that's what they're selling to the American people. And our media is such that that's the message they'll get. So is Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, susceptible to this kind of pressure? Not only from the White House, Pentagon, but from the military industrial lobby, the people that put money in Mike Johnson's pocket? Well, that remains to be seen. And so, long story short, Colonel Wilkerson, who was a good friend of mine, a very respected friend of mine, and I decided to write, look, people need to have something out there that they can appeal to, something factual, like the analysis I used to do as an intelligence officer, and Larry Wilkerson used to do as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, okay? So we decided to construct this thing based on what had been said in the past. And just to warn congressional members, hey, look, you know, when the intelligence people come and brief you, and they bring this beautiful deluxe van in to show you how good everything is, kick the tires. Maybe that's not widely known, but before you buy a used car in our country, you kick the tires, okay? You ask them questions because, well, in a word, because their record for truthfulness, it's an unenviable record. Well, no, it's an... Their record for truthfulness is boom, like that. So we looked back and we found things that they've said in the past. So, for instance, well, July 13th of last year, President Biden got up and said, I have to tell you, Putin has already lost this war. He's already lost. Now, upon whom was he relying? Well, the head of the CIA just 6 days earlier, his name is Bill Burns, he had said, not only have the Russians suffered a strategic defeat, but, it's going to be really tough sledding for them. They just, the incapability of their military has been laid bare for all to see. That's a direct quote. So if the head of the CIA is telling the president that, and he says it 6 days later, who's to blame? I'd say the president for being naive. I'd say the head of the CIA for lying. And even before that, Nima. Even before that, in late December or early December, the year before. So the year before last, in other words, 2022, the head of national intelligence. Now, she's a woman named Averill Haines, and she sits on top of the whole pyramid of intelligence agencies, 17 in number, and they're responsible to her. And she writes, or her people write, the president's daily brief. Okay? Now, what did she tell the world? She said this openly in December of the previous year, so 2022. She said, you know, we're really optimistic about this coming offensive, this spring offensive that Ukraine has planned, because, you know, the Russians are running out of ammunition and they have no indigenous capability to replace what they've already expended. So we're looking pretty good. I'm very optimistic. Huh? Maybe she misread her briefing documents, because it's not the Russians that are running out of ammunition. It was the Ukrainians and NATO and the US. There is no more ammunition. The Russians are producing it by the plentifully. They've got a indigenous capability second to none. So this is the head of national intelligence, and she's telling her minions, including Bill Burns, who has his own capability, of course, in the CIA, that Russia has all, Putin, they always say, Putin has already lost this war. He's already lost. Now, what's the real situation? Well, we looked back in the record, and we found that Biden's, well, the president, President Obama, when Biden was vice president, I think, he resisted pressure to give lethal weaponry to Ukraine. It was really quite remarkable, because one of the few things that that Obama was able to do in facing down the military industrial complex. I remember I've been getting up, actually Angela Merkel, the head of Germany, chancellor, was in town, and they had a joint press conference. And one of the newspaper people said, "Now, Mr. President, there's a talk about you should supply lethal weapons to Ukraine. What do you say to that?" And before he could answer, Angela Merkel shouts out, "Das wäre eine schlechte Idee." That would be a lousy idea. And then she did it again. Obama, of course, said, "Well, we're deliberating about that," but he never did it. Okay, now, why didn't he do it? Well, because Obama said, and he's quoted in the New York Times, 2015. He said, "If we give lethal weaponry to Ukraine, that'll give them the mistaken idea that they could fight against the Russians and win." Now, if you compare the two countries, military-wise, population-wise, if you look at a damn map, for God's sake, you don't have to be an intelligence analyst to see who has what Obama and the smart people would call escalatory dominance, you know, the ability to escalate at will, okay? The Russians have that, and Obama knew it. And so he said, "Look, you know, don't give the Ukrainians the idea that they could beat the Russians. They can't." Now, when he said that, he also said later that, look, you know what a core interest is? A core interest is something that a country will fight to the death for, because it endangers their national security. Now, is Ukraine a core interest of Russia? Do they want NATO right up against Russia? And Obama answered the question himself. Of course they don't. Okay. Now, how about, is Ukraine a core interest of the United States? Well, hello, no way. So we really ought to be very careful, says Obama, about getting into wars when we don't really have a core interest here. Okay. Now, when all this was going down in 2015, the Deputy Secretary of State made a major speech. He was talking to, oh, he's in Berlin, talking to a German group. And this is a couple of sentences. This is so rich that I want to quote them, okay? I'm not making this up, okay? Quote, senior State Department official, quote, if you're playing on the military terrain of Ukraine, you're playing to Russia's strength because Russia is right next door. Oh, good. He looked at the map. Russia is right next door. It has a huge amount of military equipment and military force right there, right on that border. Anything we did as countries in terms of military support for Ukraine is likely to be matched and then doubled and then tripled and then quadrupled by Russia, period, end quote. Thus far, the words of Antony J. Blinken, Deputy Secretary of State at the time, you know? Now, it befuddles me, Nima. How did they change their mind? Did they rearrange the map, or did they say, well, the Russians can't produce these weapons, or what did they do? How did, why, what accounts for the way they changed their mind, you know? So I guess the other thing that we raised here was that if there's anybody in the U.S. government right now that knows how the Russians felt or feel about the prospect of NATO coming right up to the Russian border, it's William Burns, now head of the CIA, who was the U.S. ambassador in Russia in February of 2008. Now, what happened? Well, in early 2008, there were a lot of rumors going around that Bush and Cheney wanted to get Ukraine into NATO, Ukraine and Georgia. Now, everyone sensible advised against that, but now they're going out to ride into the sunset the next year. And so they persuaded their toady vassals, West Germany and France, to go along. They said, look, would you like to have that? And these guys said yes. Okay. So the 1st of February, 2008, William Burns gets a call from the Russian foreign minister. Foreign Minister Lavrov wants to see you like right now, today. Okay. So he goes to the foreign ministry. Lavrov ushers him into the room and says, Mr. Burns, do you know what Niet means? No. Niet, of course, means no. Burns says, well, yeah, I think so. He says, well, Niet means Niet. We have a red line here in Russia. If you let Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, that's a red line for us. We will have to decide what to do. Now, in Ukraine, there will inevitably be a civil war, and we will have to decide whether to intervene or not, says Lavrov, okay? We don't want to have to decide that, so please tell your people back there, Niet means Niet. And Burns played it straight. And the title he gave his cable back from Embassy Moscow, and we have that cable thanks to WikiLeaks, okay? The cable says, Niet means Niet, Russia's red lines on NATO admission of Ukraine and Georgia, okay? Now, not only that, but Burns was pretty forward. In those days, for an ambassador to say something that wasn't really consonant with U.S. policy was a big danger, okay? But Burns did it anyway. He summed up the courage to say, Condoleezza Rice, his superior as Secretary of State. You know, Russia is really livid. It's neuralgic about this. Everyone from the knuckle draggers at the bottom of the basement of the Kremlin to the highest officials, they react really strongly to this. And you know, you can understand it, because this is a core interest of theirs. They've had a really bad experience of armies coming through Ukraine, and they don't want that to happen again. So every country is entitled to have strategic interests. So it's more than just neuralgia. It's now, that was Bill Burns, the 1st of February, 2008. Okay. Well, most people know that 2 months later, in Bucharest, at a summit of NATO, the head of Germany and the head of France deferred to Bush and Cheney. He said, oh, all right, yeah, let's make them. And the declaration in Bucharest was on the 3rd of April, Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, quote, end quote. Okay, so fast forward now. People know what happened, right? That was 2008. The U.S. supported a overthrow of the duly elected Ukrainian government in February of 2014, right? Then there was everything went down, downhill from there. And so now what does Bill Burns say? We were afraid of this. You know, there's some people that were hoping that Bill Burns would be like the adult in the room. I harbored some of that hope, but no. He's a cog in the wheel of the bureaucracy. State Department people almost always just do what they're told to do. It was, the exception was when Bill Burns was so frank about Russia being entitled to have geopolitical concerns, okay? But no more exception for Bill Burns. Now he was one of the first to say, oh, this invasion of Ukraine by Russia is completely unprovoked. It's got that? Unprovoked, when he knows damn well Lavrov told him, look, you do this, you try to get Ukraine into NATO, and that will provoke us. Now we know the rest of that. So we cited that in this memo too, and said, look, you know, you ought to really remember that. And not only that, but you know, after what happened in February of 2014, when the overthrow of the Yanukovych government was done, and when again, the Germans and the French promised that they would work real hard under the Minsk Agreement to give a measure of autonomy to Donetsk and Lugansk so that there could be some respect for the Russian traditions there, but the Russian people speaking Russian. And Putin sat still for that for 7 years, okay? So Merkel and Hollande had sort of had guaranteed that, but these same people just acquiesced in the new policy. So instead of Angela Merkel saying, "Eine schlechte Idee" for arms help to Ukraine, unless they think they could take on Russia, and now she, oh, eine gute Idee und eine wunderbare Idee. So, you know, these vassals, they just do whatever the U.S. president tells them to do. Obama says, oh, I agree with you, Angela Merkel. Yeah, this is a schlechte Idee. But Biden says, no, why don't we try this? And Angela Merkel says, oh, yes, oh, eine gute, eine wunderbare Idee. Okay, so that's kind of distasteful. Now, one other thing we pointed out, Larry Wilkerson and I, is that there are some honest analysts left in the bowels of some of these agencies. Sadly, I don't know if there are any left in the CIA, or if there are, whether they have any voice in what happens. But in the Defense Intelligence Agency, there was one gutsy Marine general, Lieutenant General, 3-star, who was heading up DIA, 2015, 16, 17, right after the coup in Kiev, as that we orchestrated, okay? And there's no doubt that we orchestrated. It was the most blatant coup in history, since it was advertised on the 4th of February, 2.5 weeks before the coup, on YouTube. You could look that up. It's quite an amazing thing. Anyhow, they went ahead with the coup anyway. So what did DIA say? Well, in a major congressionally mandated study, the DIA pointed out, and I quote here because it's really kind of, it's not McGovern making it up, okay? This is from Russian Military Power, published in December 2017. Quote, "The Kremlin is convinced the U.S. is laying the groundwork for regime change in Russia, a conviction further reinforced by the events in Ukraine. Moscow views the United States as the critical driver behind the crisis in Ukraine and the Arab Spring, and believes that the overthrow of former Ukrainian President Yanukovych is the latest move in a long-established pattern of U.S. orchestrated coups," period, end quote. So when you hear people say, Putin, he's paranoid. He thinks that the U.S. and the West is trying to overthrow his God. Paranoia, why would we do that? DIA thought that's what Putin thinks. DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, didn't think he was paranoid. And of course, neither do Larry Wilkerson and I. And if push comes to shove, and you need more proof, well, it was almost 2 years ago now, a year and a half ago, that our defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, talked about, I ought to quote him too, because we don't want to miss this. "One of the U.S. goals in Ukraine is to see a weakened Russia. The U.S., and this is a quote, folks, the U.S. is ready to move heaven and earth to help Ukraine win this war against Russia." Okay. So Putin and his advisors, of course, are reading that. And so please don't call them paranoid. And lastly, Larry Wilkerson and I thought it'd be a good idea if we updated this and inserted the latest, and that is former President Trump's warning. My God, if NATO members don't pay up, if they don't bear their share of the expenses, well, one NATO leader of a major country asked me, if we don't pay up, are you going to defend us? And I said, no, I encourage the Russians to do whatever they want to you. Now, okay. Bluster? Of course it's bluster. But what do the Russians want to do to you? There's no sign, there's no evidence at all that the Russians want to take over all of Ukraine, much less invade Poland or the I've been in these places. I don't know. Let me put it in Putin's mouth. He's asked by Tucker Carlson, Would you want to invade Poland or the Baltic states? He says, put your move. For what? Why would I want to do it? Okay. So the whole thing is based on a false premise, but people in the United States have been so brainwashed on Putin that they're prepared to believe that Putin won't stop at the edge of Ukraine. We go to Poland and the Baltic Sea. Before you know it, in a couple of weeks, he'll be at the English Channel. Ridiculous, as the British would call it. What do they call it? We say garbage. They say something else. But that's what it is. Garbage. Rubbish is what they say. Okay. Now, we decided we needed to include that because all this stuff is so artificially stoked by media in the West. And so for people to believe that it's a realistic prospect that Russia might go west after taking Ukraine is so artificial that we thought we really ought to include that. Now, just to wind up on this, again, the timing was important. Larry and I did this a week ago, all right? A week ago. It just appeared yesterday. Why? Well, we were hoping that some major media might be interested. So, you know, we were hoping that for once there would be an alternative view allowed in the pages of some of these broadsheets and other places. But no, that was not to happen. So it was published on the best website I know, Consortium News. It is getting around. And the bottom line here is that Representative Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, said, all right, go on vacation for 2 weeks. You're off for 2 weeks. And of course, the president got very angry about that. How can they go on vacation when Ukraine is in need of this stuff? Well, the answer is, even if you give Ukraine $60 billion, the Russians are still there. They have the will and they have the means to prevent any Ukrainian victory. If you want to weaken Russia, figure out another way to do that. So we're hoping that some sense can be injected into this discussion and that our op-ed in Consortium News yesterday, you know, may get around and may inform people. People like Code Pink, who are in congressional offices every day trying to talk some sense into these representatives and senators, not only about Ukraine, but about Gaza as well. So at least they have a piece of paper now that shows what Obama said, what Blinken said at the time. Now he changed, why he changed his mind, we ought to ask him, okay? And how this whole thing plays out in a rhetorical or propagandistic way so that most Americans tend to believe that, yeah, well, it's Putin. He's got these horns on, and he'll take Poland. He'll take, you know, he'll go to the English Channel, and maybe even Britain. He wouldn't try to take Ireland. The Irish are too tough.
Coming to the case of Alexei Navalny in Russia, I want to know your take on the situation that the media is going crazy about this and compare it with the situation of Julian Assange that was not supported by media nor by the government.
Good question. Yeah, with respect to Navalny, you know, one has to be human, okay? Stay human. I feel really bad about that, especially for his wife and his two children. My God, that shouldn't happen. Now, in a political sense, it is just short of bizarre that the President of the United States got up immediately and said, Putin did it, Putin did it. We don't have any evidence of what happened, but Putin for sure did it. You know? And others are saying, of course Putin did it, look, because he's the devil incarnate. No one asks, why would Putin want to do my God, you know, at this particular point in time, Putin's riding high. The last thing he needs is to make it possible for the West to do another propaganda campaign against him. So let's wait and see what the Russians say about an autopsy. Well, people are already saying, well, I can't trust the Russians. You know, they'll have an autopsy and it won't matter. Well, if you want to say that, okay. Now, about Navalny himself, you know, I've always had really doubts about this guy. You know, he was what the Russians call Герой нашего времени, the hero of our times, to many people like Victoria Nuland and others. But, you know, the charges that the Russians brought him up on, they seem sensible. I forget what they were now. But the business about his involvement with Western security services? Well, there is that video, for God's sake. What's the name of the guy? I wrote it down here. He's a Brit. Yeah. Oh, it's William Thomas Ford, a British MI6 intelligence agency operative, kind of a case manager for Navalny. Now, he was caught on tape in a very compromising discussion with, at first it was said, Navalny. But turns out it wasn't Navalny. But corroboration of a kind came true when just a couple of days later, no, it wasn't Navalny. It was one of Navalny's personal assistants. So, you know, so it wasn't Navalny, no, but it was one of Navalny's people. And the conversation is captured. It's very damaging. And, you know, you don't have to be a ultra skeptic to think that Navalny was getting some support of the kind that the MI6 and the National Endowment for Democracy and other things. So he's always suspect. I admire the way he spoke out, but, you know, he was a shadowy character. And like Zelensky, being used for imperial purposes on the part of our government and the old imperial government that used to be Great Britain. So that's my take on Nick Benally. The real bottom line is that he was of no consequence in terms of Putin's reelection prospects. He had no real following there, except for a certain group of folks that didn't amount to much. And so, you know, it was no threat to Putin. So I would ask the president, well, why would Putin kill him at a time when he doesn't need to kill him, and would it be extra embarrassing for him? I mean, what's it for Putin? So anyhow, I would dismiss them. Now, the hand-wringing about Navalny, wow, is that different from what should be the hand-wringing about Julian Assange? Now, as you know, this week, the 20th and 21st in London, the final plea, most people say is the final plea, to avoid extradition to the United States for Julian Assange is being heard. In other words, the British are going to decide whether to extradite him. The British have been tone deaf to all entreaties by everyone, including the Australians, who say, look, he's an Australian citizen. Well, you know, it used to be that citizenship meant something. I mean, if you go back to Roman times, remember when St. Paul was traveling around there in Asia Minor, and he was put in prison, and he appealed. He said, I'm a Roman citizen. You can't treat me this way. Civis Romanus sum. I'm a Roman citizen, okay? Well, the jailers let him right out and says, okay, you appeal to Rome? You go to Rome. Now, these days, you know, to say Civis Australiensis sum, I'm an Australian citizen, or a British citizen, or Americanus sum, it didn't amount to a hill of beans. I mean, there's no real protection by saying, look, I'm an American citizen. What they did to Ed Snowden, for example, they deprived him of his citizenship en route to Moscow. That's why he ended up in Soviet in Russia. So what am I saying? I'm saying that it's this is the big week for Julian Assange. I should say that he's a good friend of mine. I used to visit him at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was cooped up for several years. Now he's been cooped up in the maximum security Belmarsh prison in London for 5 years now. Okay. So the question is, what is this guy like, and why are they out to get him? Well, he exposed war crimes, not only in Afghanistan, but in Iraq. And he exposed all manner of other things. The reason we know, I think I mentioned this before, the reason we know what Lavrov, Foreign Minister Lavrov, told Bill Burns on the 1st of February 2008 is because WikiLeaks got access to that cable, that Moscow cable, and made it available to all of us. Was it authentic? Well, in my job as chief of the Soviet foreign policy branch way back in the day, well, I must have reviewed thousands and thousands of cables from Embassy Moscow. I could tell an authentic cable. And of course, nobody has really denied that this is authentic. Bill Burns hasn't denied it. So that's how bad WikiLeaks was infringing upon the ability of our governments to work in secret and do things like what they've done to Julian Assange, and worse still, if you will, war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. So here we are in 2010, and Assange is riding high. He has just given the Afghanistan war logs to the press, and they're pouring over them, and some of them are being reproduced in the New York Times and the Guardian and other places, okay? And it's a major event. Well, what happens? Well, he goes to a conference in Stockholm, Sweden, and there he is attracted by two women with whom he has sexual relations in the next couple of days. Now, when you see this kind of thing made public, you always ask, cui bono, who benefits from this kind of thing being made public? Well, here's the story. He did have these sexual contacts with these two women who knew each other, by the way. It was unprotected, and it's disputed as to why that was the case. But both sides, both women and Julian, say it was consensual. Yeah, no problem. It was not rape. Okay. So how did the Swedish police get involved in this? Well, the two women were a little worried that since it was unprotected, that Julian might have HIV. And they wanted him to get tested. And Julian said, look, I was just recently tested. I don't have it. Relax. Okay. But I suppose you can understand. The women were still... So they made this fatal mistake of going to the Swedish police, who have very, very close contacts with the MI6 station in Stockholm, with the CIA station in Stockholm. And the Swedish police decided that despite what these women were saying, this was rape, pure and simple. They leaked that to a newspaper. And before you know it, despite the protestations of these two women, Julian was slandered by charges of rape. Now, I happen to know as an intelligence analyst that within the quiver of tools that can be used to defame or denigrate somebody, rape is the highest arrow in this quiver. I mean, it always works. The Israelis are using it now against Hamas. Rape is a terrible crime. So you brand somebody a rapist, That usually takes care of the case. Now, how do we find out about all this? Well, there is a post in the UN called the UN Rapporteur for Torture, okay? And the fellow in charge then was Niels Melzer, a Swiss. He speaks fluent American English. And I asked him about that. I said, Niels, you're fluent in English as well as German and French, you know, but how come it's American English? He says, Ray, I spent a couple of high school years in Tampa, Florida. So anyway, that's beside the point. What he does is he hears about this Julian Assange, and he says, oh, my God, you know, what a rapist. I mean, you know. And WikiLeaks is going to the UN Rapporteur for Torture, Niels Melzer, and saying, look, he's being tortured, for God's sake. He's in Belmarsh prison. We've visited him. He's being tortured. You ought to look into it. Now, who wants to be seen as trying to defend a rapist? Or, as other spurious charges had it, somebody who was mean to his cat, or somebody who didn't flush the toilet. My God, they threw the whole nine yards at Julian Assange. Who wants to be seen as defending such a mensch, okay? Well, WikiLeaks is, if anything, very persistent. They finally persuaded, look, Mr. Melzer, will you please just visit Julian Assange at Belmarsh? And he did. And he had the presence of mind to bring a psychiatrist and another medical doctor with him. They found, pure and simple, that Julian Assange was being subjected to psychological torture. Okay. Now, Niels Melzer, I got to know him in the process of all this. He wrote this wonderful book, well, I have it somewhere, about this whole case. Being a responsible official of the UN as head of, Rapporteur for Torture, he decided to look into this. He said, this is, why are they doing this? Why are they torturing him? Why are they keeping him with minimal charges in a maximum security prison? So what did he do? He said, I'm going to go to Sweden. I'm going to see if they'll let me look at those documents. Yeah. So he made arrangements to go to Sweden. What he knew, and what the Swedes apparently didn't know, that Niels Melzer is fluent not only in German and French and English, but in Swedish. Oh my God. So they gave him access to the police records, and they saw the whole shebang. What I just told you about how this went down, I got that from Niels Melzer. He got them from the emails and everything that were exchanged, and he saw how these women were so upset. He read their emails with what the Swiss police, with encouragement from guess who, did to accuse Julian Assange of being a rapist. Now, as Niels Melzer wrote, that was the end. That was the end of Julian Assange. That's how they got him. Okay? And that is how they got him. Eventually, you had to seek asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, and then when the Ecuadorian government fell, they threw him out of the embassy, and he's been in Belmarsh Icus security prison for 5 years. So what's the deal here? Well, Niels Melzer wanted the world to know what all has happened. So he wrote this book, but even before he wrote the book, he did several interviews with people I know and with me. And he told the whole nine yards about this. And then on the anniversary of the UN Convention Against Torture, I think it was, he wrote an op-ed spelling out chapter and verse. Okay. Now, he shopped that around to the London Times, to the Guardian, to all the Australian newspapers, to Newsweek, to the New York Times, to Reuters, to the Washington Post. He, the UN Rapporteur for Torture, could not get the article published. He says this when he published, self-published the article, and he puts it in the last paragraph. By the way, here are the newspapers that turned me down. So what does that tell you? Well, it tells you a lot about what they're doing to Julian Assange. So what we're hoping is that we can get this word out and that people can finally see that they've been led down the Gordon path on Julian Assange as well as on Ukraine and everything. Now, these people lie through their teeth. And in this case, a whole lot is at risk because we have a First Amendment, right? And the First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech and freedom of the press, okay? These were rights that were wrested from King John of England in 2015. Do you remember the Magna Carta? Okay. They were wrested from King John by noble people, the English nobles. It wasn't, you know, they felt strongly that there should be the equivalent or something similar to what our forefathers fought for the Bill of Rights. And they won, and they got these rights. Now, that was 800 plus years ago, okay? What's the difference now? Well, I'm not trying to be smart here, but there aren't any English nobles around anymore. English courts are a farce, and nothing has made this clearer than the process against Julian Assange. So you have the First Amendment in our Constitution that guarantees freedom of speech writing to a publisher. Julian Assange is a publisher. Now, what will happen if he is extradited and put in prison for the rest of his life? I'll tell you what will happen. Every reporter will have in the back of his or her mind, oh my God, if I report this, no one is beyond the reach of the CIA worldwide. If I report this, they're going to get me, just like they got Julian Assange. I'm Danish. I'm Brazilian. I'm Indonesian. They're going to get me anyway. I mean, Julian Assange is not American. He's an Australian. They're going to get me. So what will almost all journalists do? They'll say, well, better not take a chance here. I mean, look what happened to Julian. He's still wasting away in a maximum security prison, not in Belmarsh anymore in London, but in Colorado or someplace like that. So the implications of this thing are immense. Now, how does the president feel about this? Our president, Joe Biden. Well, when Julian was arrested, or even before that, when he was charged with being a rapist, and Joe Biden was asked, what do you think? He says, he's a terrorist. Terrorist. My God, terrorist? Well, that's what Joe Biden said, okay? What does he say now? Well, he's not willing to listen to the Australia government, which has finally come all the way around and appealed for him to be released from Britain, sent to his home in Australia. He's not come around at all. Would he want to? I don't know. I can't read the mind of the man. But, you know, if he has a measure of conscience left, doesn't seem to be at work very much on genocide in Gaza. But let's say got a measure of conscience left. Let's say he wanted to honor the First Amendment to our Constitution. Well, you know, would he have the power to do that? And the answer to that is no, he doesn't. Why? Because he's not in charge. The people who want to put Julian away forever, the military, industrial, and media complex, they're in charge. Okay, well, we know that. Even Putin talking to Tucker Carlson, hinted that about three or four times during saying, who would I talk to? You know, who's in charge? And, you know, all this stuff. So that's the sad reality. Now, that's why I made a recording just last night, and that will be played in London today at demonstrations of one kind or another. And we're trying to rally people who feel strongly about the First Amendment to realize what the implications are. Say one more thing, on a personal level. I know Julian well. I remember the first time I met him. We were in London. We were preparing to have a Sam Adams Associates for Integrity and Intelligence award ceremony. And there were about five of us there, Sam Adams Associates, and he hosted a dinner. And this is 12 years ago or so. And we were in the ante room, such as it is, not very big. And he came through the door. And luckily, I was the first one he saw. And so I went up there, and he had not seen me before, I didn't think. And so I said, "Julian, Ray McGovern." And he says, "I know." And I said, "Well, you read my stuff?" He said, "Oh, I don't read your stuff. I see you on YouTube." Now, here's a lesson. It took several years to get through my head, you know? Nobody reads my stuff. Especially the younger generation. I mean, they see me on YouTube. Hopefully, right here, okay? So, you know, he was 39 at the time. So he's no, you know, no teenager or no, you know, no 20-ish. So he already knew, of course, how you get through to people. So that was it. Now, on a more serious note, we talked to him. We had a wonderful dinner just to watch people like Tom Drake and other really specialized technical people talk to Julian in an animated way where only they could understand the language, like it was Sanskrit to the rest of us, you know. But Julian was always animated, you know. And I saw him several times after that in the Ecuadorian embassy. I guess the one thing I wanted to point out is that this is a guy who cares, okay? He's thoughtful, he's enterprising, energetic, and really inventive. He's also, what's the word? He's willing to take risks for other people, for justice, for truth. You don't find that to the degree you find that in Julian. You don't find that many other places. So anyhow, in terms of his thoughtfulness, his altruism, or what's a better word? His selflessness, okay? You don't find too many selfless people. You find a lot of selfish people. Okay, so here you go. I'm sitting on a couch with Julian a couple of years later. Ed Snowden had just been wrapped up. Not wrapped up, actually. He had just divulged all that information about gross violations of the Fourth Amendment this time in our country. People snooping on all our telephone, all our email. You know, when I heard this, I said, "Now, come on, come on." So I asked one of Tom Drake's buddies, who is a technical director at NSA, former. I said, "Bill Binney?" I said, "Bill, I can't believe that they collect everything." And he says, "Ray, trust me, they do." I said, "Well, why would they do that?" "Because they can. But there's laws against that." "Really, laws against that? Give me a break. This is all secret stuff. And that's why they hate Ed Snowden. Now it's not secret anymore." Okay. So Ed went out there. Talk about selflessness. He went out to Hong Kong. And because he knew this is the direction he had to go, had these meetings with real reporters, just as he put it, just down the road from the CIA station. And Ed Snowden said, explicitly, "I expect they'll wrap me up and I'll spend the rest of my life in prison." Whoa, So what's the story here? I'm sitting next to Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. And I said, Julian, you know, I admire a lot of stuff that what you've done, but no more than getting Ed Snowden out of Hong Kong into safety. A coincidence that he ended up in Russia. They're the only ones that would take him. But he's got a family now. He got two small boys. His wife was loyal. His girlfriend was loyal to him. I mean, you know, Julian, you are real mensch, okay? And he looked at me and says, well, thanks. But, you know, I just did what needed to be done. And then he thought to himself, and he jumped up off the couch and he said, yes, we had to make sure that one whistleblower, a big whistleblower responsible for revealing all important secrets, would not have to spend the rest of his life in prison. Think about that. So, just to add a word here, what the stakes were with respect to Ed Snowden, who, as I say, is free and willing and able to contribute to cybersecurity and to unveiling more secrets of what's going on that governments want to hide. The Fourth Amendment, well, you know, he talked about turnkey tyranny. If you prescinded from not only the First Amendment, but the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, for those of your listeners who see if I can remember how it reads, it's very important. It's actually the most clearly defined amendment of all of the Bill of Rights, I find. Here it is. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue except upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the people or things to be seized, period, end quote. Now, NSA was making a mockery of that. Ed Snowden, to his credit, said, this is un-American. I'm going to blow a whistle on this. He did, and he escaped. He escaped what my friend Julian Assange risks now by virtue of Julian sticking his neck out, calling in all his chips from Asia, sending Sarah Harrison, one of his chief lieutenants, to be with Ed, on getting on that Aeroflot plane, landing in Moscow, staying with him at Sheremetyevo Airport for 6 weeks or so until the Russians said, okay, you can come in. So, you know, if Julian were less of a man, he would have said, oh, this is not going to make me... This is going to get the Americans even more mad at me. I mean, God, what's going to happen to me if I didn't give a fuck? As I say, Julian is, I consider him sort of a taciturn, measured guy. But that was one time when his emotions took over, he jumped off the couch, and yes, we had to make sure that one whistleblower, like Ed Snowden, make it to peace and safety. So, why do I say all this? I say all this because the stakes are really, really high. It's not only the First Amendment. They're still violating our Fourth Amendment on the pretext of defending us from terrorists, all that kind of stuff. Fourth Amendment is also being played fast and loose with. And those of us who have a really strong attachment to the Constitution, which includes me, which I'm happy to say, if we don't defend Julian Assange, if we don't speak up to him now, now's the time. It's the 21st when this decision will come down from the British court. We have to sensitize American people and others who are interested to the stakes involved here because they're very, very high. The more so in my view or in my feeling because Julian is a good friend whom I admire greatly.
And how they nabbed and how they defamed and slandered Julian from the get-go. It's an old arrow in the quiver of intelligence services. I know it well. Being used now by Israel, isn't it? Okay, let's turn to a not-so-edifying witness, okay? We're talking about Stratfor. That's a government contractor. Some people say that it really works for the CIA, but it's involved in all kinds of things, including some substantive analysis, quasi. What happens? All of a sudden, some Stratfor emails are disclosed and put out in the open air for people to see. I wonder who did that. It was WikiLeaks. And when they did that, they had a press advisory, a press conference, and they said, look, here's the press release. Confidential emails obtained from U.S. private intelligence firm Stratfor shows that the United States government has had a secret indictment against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange for more than 12 months. The date of this press release, February 28, 2012. That's how far back this goes, okay? Now, they talk about this Fred Burton. Now, he was the VP in charge of security. What was his previous job? He was deputy head of diplomatic security for the U.S. State Department. Burton, his emails were uncovered, and he revealed that there was this secret grand jury that had already issued a secret indictment against Assange. Not for publication, says this email. Please protect, end quote. No wonder they hate WikiLeaks, right? Okay, here's more. I describe this as a kind of a treatment regime. This is the, you know, as you get doctors together and they figure, well, what kind of treatment regime should we use for that? Well, that's what Burton is saying here. I'm going to read 8 parts of this treatment regime. And the last 4 I'm going to read very slowly so you can get an idea of what's in store for Julian Assange if and when he is extradited to the United States. Here's Fred Burton. We got to bankrupt the arsehole. Then we ruin his life. 2. Big Brother owns his liberal terrorist arse. Pile on. Move him from country to country. I look forward to Manning and Assange facing a bajillion thousand counts of espionage. Now, these are the 4, these next 4. These all come right out of the emails from Fred Burton, former head of, or deputy head of, diplomatic security for the United States State Department. Okay. Here are the 4 I want you to remember. Screw terrorist Assange. He'll be eating cat food in prison forever. Declassify the death of a source and blame it on Assange. Translation, you say that somebody who has died as a result of revelations from WikiLeaks, and you blame that on Assange. A little cynical, it's par for the course. And the last one, pay attention now. This is the diplomatic way that the former head of diplomatic security for the State Department puts it in quote, his a quotation from his email under Stratfor. Assange needs his head dunked in a full toilet bowl in Gitmo. End quote. These are all direct translations from those Stratfor emails that, ironically enough, WikiLeaks uncovered and published. Now, That's a dozen years ago, huh? You think anything has changed? Nothing has changed at all. Even if President Biden had a vestige of self-respect and conscience, he couldn't pardon Julian Assange because the deep state would not let him do it, okay? And so just, you know, as a closing note here, that's what's in store if we don't prevent the extradition, okay? And if we don't prevent it, if we prevail, as good sometimes does, well, then we can go by the adage that Julian, who's over here in my behind me here, right underneath that picture is that wonderful, wonderful aphorism that Julian coined. And think about it, folks. Think about how many wars are raging right now. And what Julian said was, you know, if wars can be started by lies, they can be ended by truth, okay? They can be ended by exposure. That's what's at stake here. Freedom of the press, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures are basic freedoms. There are no English nobles left. What we have to do is create the pressure to make sure that Julian is brought home to Australia safe and sound to live out the rest of his life finally in peace.